This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Lake Michigan's shoreline is eroding. What exactly is happening and how will it affect towns close to the lakefront or some of your favorite activities on the lake? With us now to learn the ins and outs of what's happening to Lake Michigan is Thomas Hook, director of the Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant and professor at Purdue University's Department of Forestry and Natural Resources. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Thank you.
Thomas, why is it important to study erosion when it comes to places like Lake Michigan?
Well, it's something that's happening quite a bit now. We've seen a lot of erosion throughout the Great Lakes, and including in Indiana waters of Lake Michigan. And it's important because it leads to real property damage. It leads to loss of recreational areas. And so there are some really important implications of this, of the erosion.
Well, after a recent visit to the lakefront, I noticed that it seems like more of the lakefront is starting to disappear, both in Illinois and in Indiana. And it made me wonder if it was erosion. And then I kind of went down the rabbit hole of researching, and I came across an article in the Indy Star that surprised me because the headline mentioned that the lakefront is eroding more than it ever has in the last 40 years. I mean, what could be the cause of something to spur such a fast change?
Yeah, so erosion happens when water gets pushed up against the land. And water in Lake Michigan, is always moving around. Water, the motion of water in the Great Lakes is almost entirely wind-driven. So that's a little bit different than oceans where you have, lunar and solar tides and stuff. So you have the wind blows and it sets the lake in motion. Sometimes you get intense wind that pushes water really up onto the shoreline. You have something called a seiche, where you have a sustained wind blowing in a particular direction where you can get a lot of water that pushes up in the shoreline. But then also once the water starts blowing, you sort of get this sloshing around of water in the lake. It's kind of like in a bathtub, right? So if you push water one end of the bathtub and the water shoots the other side of the bathtub, and then sloshes back the other way and can even sort of slosh around the outside of the bathtub. And it's something very similar in Lake Michigan, where water is sloshing around after it's set into motion by wind. And that always happens. There's always wind, there's always storm events, we're always having water moving. And whether or not that's going to be a huge problem in terms of erosion sort of depends on where we are in terms of the sort of baseline water level in the lake, sort of what the average water level is. So sometimes the average, the overall water level in Lake Michigan is pretty low. And then if you have that water moving around, it's only going to get so high. It's only going to have so much of an impact on the land. It's not going to reach as far into land. Whereas if the water level's high, the water level is high, when that water starts moving around, you have these storm events, you have these intense wind events, you can have water really getting very far up the shoreline. And so the reason that we've had issues here recently is because the water levels have been pretty high in Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. And I say Michigan and Huron together because it's really a single lake. We think of those as two separate lakes, but they're it's really a single lake, and we can't regulate one without the other. So the water levels have been really high, particularly last year. They were high. They've come down a little bit now, but particularly last year, they were very high. And that's really why we had such high erosion.
Well, are we seeing, is it a drastic sort of erosion? I mean, or is that not accurate? Are we just scaring ourselves by thinking like this is just happening quicker than it's ever happened before?
It's pretty, the water level has been really high, and clearly there is a lot of erosion. I think there is a little bit of short-termism, I think, in the sense that if we were to go back about 8 years ago, people were freaking out in Lake Michigan, not because the water levels were so high, but because they were so low. So like around 2013, we had incredibly low water levels, and there were essentially mud flats out of the lake, and people were worried about that. Now we've had a dramatic change in water levels over an 8-year period, and I think that's what's kind of freaked people out. whether it is something to be very concerned about and aware of going forward, because we are likely to see continued changes in water levels going forward. That's something that if we go back for the last 100 years, the Army Corps of Engineers and others have been monitoring water levels, and we've seen, big changes. Water levels in Lake Michigan have always been changing. They don't change, from day to day, but on sort of a decadal type of cycle or decadal timescale, we've seen big changes in water levels, and that's likely to continue in the future. There's some thought that with climate change, we might actually see not an increase in lake levels going forward, but more variation in lake levels. We may see a greater change from year to year in terms of lake levels in Lake Michigan. And so the lake levels that we've seen, that we saw last year, and the still high lake levels are cause for concern. They may go down, but there's a very high likelihood that we're going to see high lake levels again sometime in the future.
Well, I've seen in some areas where there are rocks that are piled up or sandbags to kind of, I guess, combat the rising water levels. I'm not sure if that helps at all in containing the lake.
No, I think it can have a positive effect to protect a really local area. I think one thing that may happen when you build those type of armored structures is that some of the water that comes inshore that can cause erosion just kind of gets diverted. And so, one might build an armored structure to protect a particular building or particular area, and that may just transfer some of the erosion to the neighboring areas instead. So it can definitely have a local positive effect in terms of limiting erosion, but sort of cumulatively, it may not have a positive effect.
Well, if lakes naturally move with time to other areas, or if this erosion is part of the process, is it even a good idea to build near them? I mean, I'm imagining some property owners are probably really worried with the water getting closer and closer.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a takeaway with this. So if we're going to continue to see variation in lake levels, and as I mentioned, we might see even more variation in lake levels in the future, I think we really need to be cognizant of where we, build houses, build buildings, where roads are, because just because they're away from the lake over a 10-year period, that doesn't mean that they're going to be safe from intruding water in the future. That doesn't really solve the problem of buildings that are already in place, or roads that are already in place, or recreational areas that are already in place. But in terms of sort of thinking about what we construct in the future, I think we should be more cognizant of that.
Is there anything that can be done to reverse what's happening, or at least stop it somehow with the way the lake is creeping up?
So lake levels in Lake Michigan are really a function of net basin supply. And so we have water that comes into the lake in part because of water that flows in from Lake Superior. We have water that flows out through the St. Clair River and the Detroit River through Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, ultimately out the Atlantic. Those don't have that much of an effect. Really, the main effect on water levels are evaporation, precipitation, and runoff. So how much evaporation do we have and that takes water out of the system, and how much water comes in, either in terms of overlake precipitation, so precipitation that falls right on the lake, or runoff, so rivers that drain into the lake. And we probably can't have, and humans have an effect on that in the sense that human activities have contributed to climate change. But at a local perspective, there's probably not much one could do to change net basin supply. And so we're likely to see more evaporation in the future, but climate change projections also suggest that we're going to see more precipitation and more runoff on average. But those are going to become more variable. So it's that balance between evaporation and precipitation that are going to influence what lake levels look like in the future. And again, most projections suggest that we're going to see more variability. We're going to see bigger changes in water levels going forward.
What would happen if nothing was done to prevent the erosion, if we left everything alone and let it take its course?
Well, we'd probably lose some houses and buildings that are on the lakeshore. We'd probably lose some roads that are on that are right next to the lakeshore. I think those are the main things. We'd see a lot of infrastructure damage in the lakeshore for stuff that's already in place there.
And so as we get ready to wrap up here, what are some key things that our listeners can do to sort of, I guess, help the environment and prevent this erosion from happening?
Well, I think that going forward, I think people should think about where they construct houses, where they construct roads and other structures so that they're not as much at risk of changing water levels. Some of the issues with erosion that we see around the Great Lakes also come about because the shoreline's not natural. So naturally we would have more coastal wetlands. We would have sort of more of a gradual transition from lake to land. And we've in many places made that transition a lot more abrupt through the way that we've developed the lakeshore. And I think going forward, hopefully we can plan to develop the lakeshore in a more natural way that can provide some resilience from the likely continued variability in lake levels that we're going to see.
Well, thank you so much. I really want to say thank you for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate it. Thomas Hook, director of the Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant and professor at Purdue University's Department of Forestry and Natural Resources. We'll be back after a quick break. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Stobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Honeybees made headlines in the past, but what has been happening to them lately? They're a crucial part of our ecosystem, and they were dying off at one point. Is that still the case? Should we be worried about honeybees? Well, in honor of National Honeybee Day this month, we wanted to check in with a specialist on what's being done to keep honeybees safe and what role we play in making sure that we keep our planet healthy. With us now is Purdue University's apiculture specialist, Crispin Given. Welcome, Crispin.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, we want to talk about honeybees, and I know there's so many different types of bees, but what makes honeybees different than, for example, bumblebees, or are they the same thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, they have one thing in common. They both make wax, but the biggest difference is they're totally different species, and they have larger colonies. So honeybees have colonies that consist of 60,000 individuals or more. So honeybees are much better at pollinating more plants at one time than bumblebees, for example. But there's many differences biologically.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about bumblebees and honeybees. For a long time, we've heard these headlines that they're dying off. Was it a specific type of bee that was dying off, or was this applicable to all bees?
We have native pollinators, native bees. There's like 20,000 species, and we experience, there's about 200 natives here in Indiana. So there's mortality with some of these, along with honeybees. There's been some mortality, and a lot of that's due to just the current state of development as far as modernity. There's loss of habitat, for example. There's subdivisions popping up here and there. And so the loss in honeybees and natives has increased somewhat through the years, but there's also encouraging news or steps that are being made to help those losses.
Well, when you look back, like over the last 5 years, would you say that things are improving for honeybees or it's continuing to decline?
Yeah, I mean, this is a real touchy subject with some people. It's kind of safe to say, I mean, we're not really, you know, there's not a fear of the total loss of honeybees, so to speak. It's what's really going on. It's the health of the honeybees is being compromised. So if you think about the biology of bees, it's easy to make bees. In fact, there's more beekeepers now than ever, not just in Indiana, but across the country, because the interest in honeybees has increased since CCD started in 2006. There's really been a lot of interest in just helping honeybees, so that the biology of bees makes it somewhat easy to replace a colony. So let's say a beekeeper has 10 colonies and they were to lose five over the winter due to whatever circumstances. You know, the winter, they didn't have enough food stores. There's very many factors attribute to colony loss, but it's somewhat easy to replace the colony. So what a beekeeper can do is they can split their colony, or they can make what we call nucleus colonies, and they can make small divides for, they can maybe produce three nucleus colonies in one colony if it's really strong in the spring. And then they put new queens in each one of these. But the fallback on that is if one wants to produce a lot of honey, of course, if they're having to replace colonies like in the commercial industry a lot, and then they tend to not produce as much honey in some cases.
Well, speaking of the commercial industry, I'm curious, is there mass production of honey? Is that something that actually happens? And when I think about it, I'm wondering, is that harmful for bees, or it's just part of the process? I don't know.
Well, actually, you know, if you think about the biggest pollinating event on the planet actually occurs here in the U.S. It's in California in the Central Valley. Every year, beekeepers truck about 1.5 million colonies there from all over the country. And they're not going there to get honey. Most of the commercial industry is in the pollination business. So the honey is considered a byproduct of most commercial beekeepers. But yes, there are a few that indeed produce honey only, but most of them are in it for pollination. That's where the bigger payouts are. So in Indiana, we have three commercial beekeepers, and they send about 3,000, 4,000 colonies to the Central Valley every year, and then they bring their colonies back to Indiana.
So do they take their colonies there to help pollinate the area and then bring them back?
Yes, because there's so many almonds being planted, even as we speak. Sometimes there's just not enough bees in some cases. So all the colonies that they can get to pollinate the almonds sufficiently so they produce lots of crop is needed. So as many colonies as they can possibly get there, like that number is going to grow over 1.5 million in the next few years because they're planting more almonds. But it's quite an event. I was there a few years ago. I was invited by a commercial beekeeper, and they took me there for a week. And it's amazing. They have what they call holding yards. So there may be thousands of colonies in these holding yards. And if you think about it, part of the problem, as I mentioned earlier, it's, you know, with the bees, you know, there is losses attributed to many factors. And one of those factors is pests and pathogens. And the prime factor for colony mortality in the U.S. is due to the varroa mite. It's called varroa destructor. So if you think about it, it's not so much what you see. You can see this parasitic mite. It's about the size of your fist. It's really big parasite. So as it's feeding on the blood and the fat bodies of the honeybees, it's also a vectoring virus. So it's like a dirty hypodermic needle. So if you think about all these colonies in the Central Valley, 1.5 million, once they bring all those down in that one area, it's going to have a huge monoculture. So monoculture is part of the problem, too, with not just honeybees, but natives. I mean, they need diversity. But in nature, it's not considered normal, or it's not what the bees want. They don't want to be living in large groups like this. So what we have is cross-contamination, so to speak, of these different pests and pathogens, including viruses. And then those are brought back throughout the country, unfortunately. And this causes sublethal effects, or it could affect colonies going overwintering that winter due to these effects of viruses, for example.
That's so interesting, because I never thought I never knew about this, that you can take bees and take them somewhere else to do some work and then bring them back. But it does seem like it brings a problem with them, the potential problem of them getting contaminated.
Yeah, so because it's, if you think about, you know, we're experiencing, and there's a bright light at the end of the tunnel, too, I would like to talk about. But the depressing part, yes, there is mortality of honeybees, but is the world going to come to an end, and are we going to not be able to have any more food on our table? No, that's not the case. But things are certainly challenging when you have so many animals, and because that's what honeybees are. They're just animals, if you think about it. In one area, collecting all, not just the almond nectar and pollen, but they're also collecting different viruses and things there. And there's different versions of viruses, too, like the virus most associated is, they call it DWV, the form wing virus. So this causes colonies to, you know, go through mortality and not make it through the winter in some cases.
Well, did the pandemic have any positive impact on bees? For example, we saw less pollution for a little while during lockdown when people weren't driving as much. And I know I personally heard more birds chirping. I saw tons of rabbits all over the place. Did we see more bees making a return?
Well, I don't think it really affected them in a sense as far as their, you know, their health goes. There's still the parasites, the parasitic mite Varroa destructor, which originally came from Asian honeybees. It's a different honeybee. They're smaller, so they jump from one host to another. We still experience mortality. I mean, like last year the last year, we've experienced like 32% in the country mortality. So we're still losing around 30%. So it's a little higher than the previous year. And in Indiana, we actually lost around 28%. And then our population of bees at Purdue, we lost about 28% also, around 29%. One thing I got thinking, we're all going through the pandemic together and, you know, retooling our lives and making changes. I was kind of thinking our honeybees are experiencing a pandemic in themselves with the viruses and the Varroa mite that's vectoring those viruses. So they're experiencing a pandemic also.
And what is the solution for them? I mean, obviously we have vaccines. What can be done for bees?
Well, beekeepers can put miticides in their colonies. There's compounds that can be put in colonies, and there's other measures where, like, what, since I'm a honeybee breeder, I feel like bee breeding is also another way of reducing the impact of Varroa destructor. So at Purdue, I've been engaged in honeybee breeding for 17 years now. And one of the big impacts is the Varroa destructor. So we've actually been able to produce bees that have, the scientists call them phenotypes, or just different characters, if you want to think about it, that bees have. And so we're looking at behavior to reduce Varroa. And these two behaviors we're looking at is grooming and mite biting. So honeybees groom, and they also have the ability to bite the parasitic mites. So we've been able to get an uptick in that. So we've had as high as 50% mortality of mites. But we still, within our population, we have like 6 million bees that we work with. We have about 100 colonies. So it's challenging selecting for these traits. So you have to constantly select on it. But we have shown that it's heritable to do that. So I feel that, you know, this resistance to the mites is increasing also and out in the so-called wild type or feral bees.
And so you are a honeybee breeder, or one of the many things that you do. What exactly does that mean? You know, for people who are listening, they're probably going to say, wait, you breed honeybees? Don't they just breed on their own?
Yes. In fact, honeybee breeding is somewhat difficult because it takes a lot of resources and you need to have a lot of colonies. So you need to have at least 100 colonies is great. And then one difficulty with trying to breed honeybees is honeybees, they mate on the wing. So the drones are the male bees. They basically live a life of leisure in a colony. They feed themselves. They'll go out on mating flights. So the queens will fly in the afternoon to these drone congregation areas. This is where it could be tens of thousands of drones, depending on how many colonies are in the areas. So the queens fly in these areas and they mate on the wing. So all the mating occurs about 80 feet off the ground. So it's very difficult. So when the best method is either you can flood your area if you have a closed population, like you're able to keep bees on an island, for example, you could flood that area populate the island with the colonies that you like. Or in our case, we flood the area with our type of drones that we like. So we have grooming and mite biting drones that we have queens that are producing these, breeder queens. So we put drone combs. These are combs with nothing but drone cells on them. We introduce these into the colonies. The queen lays in them, and then the drones occupy the area. So we think by flooding the mating yards with our type of drones also helps the propensity in mating with those. And then we also employ instrumental insemination.
Well, what is it that fascinates you about bees? This seems like a very specialized field.
Well, as a child, I was always interested in nature, and my first love was ants. And before I could even talk, my parents were basically, all I did was watch bugs. But I started really falling in love with ants around the age of 5. And about the age of 9, my dad had some bees. He got some bees around at the age of 8. This was in 1978, before we had any of this problems that we are experiencing today. And then a year later, I just started watching the bees and taking curiosity. And then my dad got a bee suit for me and let me start managing the colony. So we used to produce comb honey, for example. So it's just the nature and the behavior of the bees is, now I know as an adult, that it's the behaviors that attracted me. I really find that social behavior among insects, honeybees and ants, for example, is extremely fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting because they're so small, but I guess if you get to zoom in on them, you see so many different things.
Oh, yes. And the architecture of the colony, if you look at the behaviors, if one, you know, takes the time and observe and watch, they learn to identify these behaviors. And sometimes behaviors like this help you get to where you want from point A to point B, so to speak, in a colony. For example, if I'm opening up a honeybee colony and I'm looking for the queen, sometimes, very often, the behavior of the bees will kind of let you know where the queen is. So they'll have a court. So the queen usually has a court of bees around her. They call a retinue. So they're literally always standing around. So when the queen becomes motionless, this court is more visible. So that's just one behavioral, you know, response that is reflected by the queen's pheromone. She has basically an invisible chemical uniform that kind of helps regulate the worker behavior in the colony. And that's one of the behaviors. So, but there's many, many behaviors in the colony that are this fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, it does sound really, really cool to be able to, observe and see what they're up to. We have about 30 seconds left. I just want to leave our listeners with some sort of action item or tips that they can take. Anything you recommend for folks to help save honeybees?
Oh, I would definitely tell them to start planting native plants, native flowers. Make, instead of having a green lawn, just make it a garden. Or if you don't want to do it in your front yard, make a section of your backyard into a native pollinator garden. That would be a real big step, not just for honeybees, but the native pollinators and native bees that live here.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate having you on. Crispin Given, apiculture specialist in the Department of Entomology at Purdue University. Coming up, there's a push and pull between employers and employees when it comes to working from home or coming into the office. Now that COVID cases are again on the rise, will more employers make remote work permanent? If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Working remotely became the big thing of 2020. And then this year, companies started talking about a return to the office, maybe part-time or full-time by the fall. Then COVID cases started to go up again with the Delta variant. And it almost feels like Groundhog Day. Are we back where we started? And why don't some employers just make the permanent decision to give their employees the choice to be fully remote? Well, our next guest is going to help us navigate this topic and understand what's at stake for companies and employees. Rebecca Ellis is an engagement executive with Align Org Solutions. Rebecca, it's great to have you back with us.
Excellent. Thank you for having me, Miriam.
Well, Rebecca, what has been the toughest thing for employers this past year and a half when it comes to the constantly changing CDC guidelines?
I think it is just that, Miriam, that they have been constantly changing. Just when we start to feel like things are stable enough to make plans and communicate those to our employee base, a new thing happens, like the Delta variant, making us reconsider those aspects. And it has really created a lot of volatility for our clients and for local employers.
Yeah, I mean, just when people thought they were going back to the office, we see this Delta variant. Some companies have begun mandating vaccinations for the employees. Other organizations have decided to make working from home a permanent solution. Why is it so hard for some companies to just come up with a policy and stick to it rather than continuing the whiplash of the back and forth?
I just think no one wants to be an outlier. I think most leaders are kind of taking the temperature of what's happening around them, either in their geography or in their industry. And no one wants to be the first to make a call that ends up being very unpopular. Just in recent news, the last couple of days, we've seen such happen with Google. Google has said you don't have to return to the office, but if you don't, you very well may have to take a pay cut. And that has blown up, been quite a viral story in the last couple of days. And so I think most leaders want to just kind of see what the quote unquote new normal will be and try to be as much in line with that as possible. We are just still at a point where talent is such a scarcity that no one wants to put themselves on the short end of being able to hire the best and brightest.
Well, I would think that remote work would enable companies to be able to reach out further than just their location.
It absolutely would. And so I think those that are willing to be more open and progressive to a remote work culture and environment are absolutely going to have the upper hand, especially when it comes to rather difficult roles to fill, like cybersecurity, as an example. When I've talked with my peers here in the last week, many of them actually are still going ahead with their plans to return to the office. About a third of the folks that I talked with said they're going to go right ahead as planned, regardless of this Delta variant. But I have another third who said, you know what, we're never going back. We're remote full time. And I think that's encouraging, especially I think as we talked last time, Indiana in our region has really been a laggard in this idea of working from home full time. where the coast have had to adopt it maybe earlier because of perhaps the nature of the work, in some cases more digital, but also because of the commutes that they suffer through that we have the advantage of not having so bad here in Indiana.
Do you see Indiana coming on board with stuff? I mean, I know that there have been some tech companies that have come to the area, so I would imagine that things are going to, I don't know, modernize. I don't know if that's the right word.
I absolutely do. I've definitely seen shifts in thinking. I have a CEO friend who would have said a year and a half ago, absolutely, we need to be in the office to get work done. And now he's one of the last wanting to go back himself. And so even folks are surprising themselves in that. And I do think that there have been shifts that will be long term for us. And I hope that we, you know, become more middle of the pack. I don't know we'll ever be the most progressive, but we're definitely not the laggards anymore, which is really encouraging. There is a lot of incredible talent here in Indiana and folks willing to relocate here as well because of our low cost of living. But I love the idea that we are thinking beyond Indiana for talent as well, because that really helps us increase our diversity, which may just not be completely available here if we're only thinking our own geography or region.
Well, there's also been talk about hybrid solutions where you can go in once a week or something like that. Do you think that that is something that will become the new way of doing work, or is that a setup for failure?
Yeah, so it's a really good question, Miriam. In the third of my peer group who are returning to the office, half of them are going back full time and half of them are going back hybrid. And I do think the hybrid model will end up increasing in popularity over time. I do think it's an interesting dilemma in that if the main reason we're trying to be more spaced or distance is because of a virus, the hybrid model is organically starting to create a lot of big waves of people in the office and then very small participation in the office. So what happens is you leave it up to a work team to be in the office 1 to 2 days a week. The folks who do work adjacent or collaboratively with them also want to be in the office those 1 or 2 days. And before you know it, it's snowballed to everyone's in on those 2 days, which, by the way, are usually not Monday and Friday. And then the office is empty the rest of the time. And so in terms of viral load and what we're trying to do around distancing, it is going to work against us when things like the Delta variant come into play.
If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking about the future of remote work and getting companies on board with Rebecca Ellis, an engagement executive with Align Org Solutions. Rebecca, speaking of the tech companies, you know, many folks think remote work is their thing, that's fine, but this job or this particular field doesn't lend itself to that. How can folks change their employer's mind and get them on board with remote work?
Yeah, so I think we had the opportunity to really put a lot of different types of work to the test when we were absolutely not allowed to be in the offices with the full quarantines and full social distancing. And so hopefully that has opened our minds. I think the ones that have probably the most difficulty making the case are areas like manufacturing or healthcare, where you literally have to be present at the job site in order to get the work done. In those cases, I've seen clients often less, likely to let a person say in finance or HR, really not that at the point of work delivery type of role, also have flexibility while others don't. And so I think it's a tough thing to manage there. Generally speaking, we have certainly types of work that can be done remote. And I think we've proven with the work that's happened in the last year that it's probably more task than we actually assumed it could be. And even just the digitalization of processes and things that we've innovated on have led us to a point where you really don't need to be in the office to do a lot of the work that was traditionally done on site.
Right. I mean, we have so much technology at our hands now that many jobs can be done sometimes more efficiently, more comfortably for some when they're not in the office. I know we've heard from listeners who've mentioned that the pandemic leveled the playing field finally for them. Maybe they have a disability and working from home is much better, but in the past they weren't listened to. Yes. And now it's an option. So has the pandemic allowed employers to see that remote work isn't a problem and in fact can be an asset?
I think in many cases it has. What we know is that we actually usually get more work from a person when they're at home because they use the commute time often to dial into work, not literally like the old school ways, but get online and actually stay online too long. And so if anything, we've created almost the opposite issue around engagement, which is that we have over-delivered and over-obligated ourselves to work because it is so available in our kitchen or dining room or whatever we've converted into our workspace. And so this idea of being always on is actually a bigger epidemic and might risk more burnout and leaves than what employers are probably thinking through today. We do know, because of the great resignation, as they're now calling it, that employers who end up not being open to the idea of a person getting to continue to work in a flexible arrangement are very likely to lose that employee. And there have been some surveys that have come out with very high numbers, like 60% of the workforce looking for a new role if they're not able to continue in that current flexible arrangement. And particularly with females, we're already in dire straits around that. We are at a 33-year low. It has been since 1988 that we've had this little participation from a percentage perspective of women in the workplace compared to men. And they're not looking to come back anytime soon. And so that is something that employers are definitely going to have to start taking into consideration when they might be thinking it's risky to have people working from home. But the bigger risk is to not have those people if they don't make the flexible plans.
Yeah, I would say it's hard once you've gotten a taste. If you had the privilege and ability to work from home, it's really hard to want to go back in.
It absolutely is hard. Deloitte ran a survey and they said that 60% of women, actually more than 60%, say that they now have more responsibilities at home in particular. And, you know, when we think about traditional household task division and how that might work around kids and managing their education, which is more complicated now in a remote or hybrid learning situation, it is definitely going to be a tough situation if you don't allow them that kind of flexibility that they've gotten used to. I also fear for our pets, right? Like my own dog may need a separation anxiety meds if we're now not at home full time because they're expecting that. And so There are just so many things that we've gotten used to, the flexibility of having people come do service on your home, taking a good mental health break and a walk around the block at noon that might not be as easy in the workplace. And so there would be a lot to give up. And that's why so many people are willing to put their job on the line if they're not allowed to continue working in that flexible way.
What do you think about our society that we fear change and feel like we have to go into an office and go through a commute to seem productive?
It's a really good question. I think it's just what we've always known, right? The status quo in the comfort zone. We always feel more comfortable with what we have experienced and what we know versus what the unknown could be. But again, we were thrown into this experiment, and I think we've proven in nearly every case that we can survive without being in that traditional workplace. And so I don't think those fears of the unknown are as fair now that we've had a chance to run that experiment. Again, I would put it in the risk benefits kind of categorization, trying to figure out, is it really worth trying to get back to quote unquote normal, considering what you might lose in that move?
I know you mentioned some of the drawbacks of remote work were just working too much. And I don't want to sound like I'm just tooting the horn for remote work selfishly for myself here. But are there any other drawbacks that you can think of?
So I actually would probably continue down more of your line of thinking. I think there are more drawbacks of getting back into a commute and back into a workplace. In particular, there is more control for people specifically who are marginalized or maybe less of a majority population in a workplace, where they can remove themselves from situations that might be aggressive, microaggressions, and things like that, and better able to kind of craft who they interact with and how they interact. Where in the office, that proverbial water cooler is not always friendly to our marginalized populations. And specifically, now that we have so many topics that we're rather polarized around, we have a lot of folks who are quite nervous about what those organic conversations could look like. And so I definitely would still suggest that we have organic conversations and that we get to know people rather authentically. But I do think working from home gives folks a little more control or agency around those conversations and how they're treated in the workplace.
I would hope that hopefully this pandemic comes to an end and we have the remote work option, because I feel like then you can travel and see the world and just experience so many different things while still working.
Absolutely. I had a coworker who traveled a couple of weeks up to see family in Canada and was able to just, you know, really kind of unplug for sure, but also not miss a beat, because it is very typical now that our work gets done remote. Another colleague, former colleague, just worked in Cabo in Mexico for a week. And again, you know, I wouldn't recommend always working through a holiday, but if your intent is to go work remote somewhere anyway, then why not work remote in a place like Cabo? And so I do love that flexibility. And even just the way that you spend your work day, I think now there's a lot more flexibility around, you know, today's back to school for a lot of folks. So we put our son on the bus, and then when he gets off here in an hour or so, you know, I'll be able to unplug for a bit, have a conversation. Where if I were in the office, I would probably not have thought to leave a couple hours early to be home and have that download and the conversation about how the first day of school went. And so it's just that work-life integration, how we better blend things together, that I don't think folks want to give up. And if part of that means I get to go work for a month in a foreign country or a different city or state, I think all the more to it. Many people, in fact, most that I know, are still delivering at or above expectations in doing so. And so there's not a big trade-off from that perspective.
I see it also as a great mental health break, just being able to put yourself in different areas, you know, getting a little fresh air, going to the beach, doing your work, just to kind of reset a little bit rather than the same monotonous schedule every day.
Absolutely. I think there are tremendous self-care type of benefits. There's been a lot of research over the years of just planning a vacation alone gives you mental health benefits, not even the actual act of being on the vacation, but just knowing that you have something to look forward to has a lift there as well. So I absolutely agree with you.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Rebecca Ellis, Engagement Executive with Align.org Solutions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Miriam.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. And as always, if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana, or you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. We also have an app called All In Vox Pop. You can find it anywhere you get your apps, and you can leave us a voice memo there. Join us tomorrow as we head over to the Friday recap, where we look back at some of the favorite conversations from this week. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.